Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Today my guest has got a story that might be hard for you to hear. Her name is Alison, and Alison was at the centre of one of the most famous criminal cases in South Africa's history, and it made her the focus of media attention there. Some years ago, Alison survived a truly terrible ordeal at the hands of two men. She was sexually assaulted and mutilated, and then left for dead. As the men walked away and left her near the side of the road, they said there was no way she could possibly survive what they had done to her. But she did survive. And she endured the assault by a strange process of detaching her mind from what was happening to her body. After the perpetrators were caught and tried and imprisoned, she wasn't quite sure how to get on with her life, but she has managed that too. And now Alison speaks to victims' support groups and business leaders all over the world. Alison, good morning.
Hello.
Before we start, I have to ask you, does talking about this bring it up again?
Not really. I think I've been doing it now so much that it's almost as if I tell it as a story, but I think I can remember it. You know, sometimes if I have to do it personally with a friend and I'm speaking and they might ask me more about what I felt at the time, then I can remember it. But generally, because I do it so much, it's more as if I tell a story. Not to take away from what I'm going to say now, but I think that's the only way that I can do it.
Does the feeling come back to you at times?
Like it can. Sometimes when I'm doing a presentation, even it can surprise me that I can feel emotion, but perhaps that's just because I'm maybe not feeling well or I'm feeling a bit, you know, down myself personally. But generally, I can talk about it now without, you know, the depth of emotion.
Do you consciously manage it? Are you able to do that?
I think so. And I think, I wouldn't be able to talk about it as often. I wouldn't want to if I was feeling it all the time. And I think the more you talk, it is true. I mean, you hear it. The more you talk about these things, the easier it gets to talk about. And I think that's really the process that I go through.
You were recommended to us as a guest by your brother, who's a listener. And I want to tell you what he said in his email. He said, the manner in which she survived, her inner strength and determination, her lack of bitterness and her serenity and humility captured the attention of the whole of South Africa. Wow, that's a lot to live up to, Alison, isn't it?
Yes, thank you, Neil.
That's your brother.
That's my brother.
That's your brother saying that.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that hit the media in South Africa. It surprised me, to be honest, but I think it was the fact that I survived something so horrific and perhaps chose to talk about it. I think that was possibly what really struck people.
Tell me about where you live in South Africa.
Oh, beautiful area. I live in an area called the Wilderness, which is part of the Garden Route, which is on the coast between Cape Town and Port Elizabeth, the two bigger cities. And it's just a beautiful area of beaches and, you know, cliff faces and mountains on the one side, the beach on the other. It's a beautiful area to visit if you are. It's a tourism mecca in South Africa.
Do you have some privacy because you were, and you still are, a famous person in South Africa?
Well, famous in inverted commas. Cause I'm not on TV every day, so I'm not stopped all the time. But there are cases when I get stopped by someone on the aeroplane or in a coffee shop. But generally, there are people who have followed the story with admiration. So they really just want to have, you know, to be able to say to me, thank you or congratulations or you've given me inspiration, which is always a nice thing.
You're being very nice about that. But people must approach you with their eyes brimming with tears and tell you how brave you are when you probably just want to read the paper. Is that what happens?
Sometimes, but I always, to me, I feel that that's their moment. They're one of maybe hundreds of people to me. It's true.
I believe you. I just feel for you. That's all.
No, most of the time, I've never been approached by someone who's made it uncomfortable. So then it's usually just, I'm pretty good at kind of turning away when I've had enough.
Fair enough too. Is this the area you live in now? Is this where you grew up in South Africa?
More or less. It's about 4 hours away from Port Elizabeth, which is the city where I grew up and where my attack actually happened. I didn't move because of the attack, but it is a nice area to live in and bring up children. And it's a smaller area. I prefer living in the smaller towns rather than the big city.
And it was your mum that brought you up, wasn't it?
Yes.
It's your mum who's your mentor, isn't it,
yeah.
Alison?
My parents were divorced when I was nine. I mean, my dad is still alive and I love him, but my mum was my bigger influence. She was the one, yes, who brought me up.
I have to ask too, why do you use the pseudonym Alison after all these years?
Well, it was really after the trial at the time. I mean, it was 15 years ago, but I was advised after the trial to keep my surname out of publicity for my parents' sake and for my sake. Just, you know, there are weirdos out there, and someone could have decided to look us up in the phone book and harass us or something after the trial.
Or decide they're going to save you or something.
Or whatever, yeah. And I think over the time, because I became more of a public figure through my story, it just continued in South Africa as a privacy. As a privacy element, and that's something that I just prefer to keep to now when I'm doing, you know, as my public persona, Alison.
You were in your 20s when the attack happened.
Yes.
What were you doing with your life at that point, Alison?
You know, just an ordinary girl. I was working as an insurance broker. You know, not that that's any more ordinary than anything else, but I think we all just, you know, live our ordinary lives. And I had spent some time overseas. I'd just got back to Port Elizabeth. I'd been back for a year. Yeah, just an ordinary girl spending social time with friends. You know, starting to build a career.
Yeah, and you're a bright person too. You graduated at the top of your class, didn't you? And all those things. You were going to, you probably had, at that stage, a big career in that industry you were
working exactly.
In.
I mean, you know, I think, you know, you never know. In hindsight, I don't know what my life would be if this hadn't happened to me. But certainly, I was planning to just go on with my life and, as you say, build a career.
What had you been doing that night?
I'd spent the night at my home. With some friends, very ordinary evening for us. A girlfriend had asked me to give her a lift home at the end of the evening, which I did. She lived just around the corner from me. So everyone had left my house. In fact, I remember I left the candles on even in my house. So I'm not sure at what point they would have burnt out, but I was just planning to be away for 5 minutes and come back.
And you dropped your friend off?
Dropped my friend off, you know, probably a flew, you know, maybe 10 minutes, the round trip. And I was back and parked my car outside my house, yeah.
And what happened then?
Well, I had already turned the engine off. I turned to the passenger seat to get some things before getting out of my car, when suddenly my car door was open. I didn't used to lock my car doors. You know, it's amazing how unaware we are, and we just think it's never going to happen to us. And my car door was opened. I turned. There was a man standing there with a knife in his hand. He put the knife up at my throat and said to me, "Move over, or else I'll kill you." And I think, although I remember everything about that night, those first few moments really were the shock. I just did exactly as he asked me without really thinking.
Do you know if they'd been observing you, or were you just picked completely randomly?
You know, it was something that I always wanted to ask them, but what came out in the court case and in their speaking afterwards, they knew where I lived because he said to me, "You live in number one, don't you?" So he knew which house, but they had been looking that night for a girl. And there were girls who came forward afterwards whose cars they'd tried to get into, who'd locked their doors. So I don't think they went for me that night, but possibly in their walking around on previous occasions, they would have, or maybe he'd just see me leave my house that night and waited for me.
It was a pretty cold-blooded thing and a calculated thing then.
Very much. They planned it.
And you were told to move over, and then he climbed into the driver's seat. I remember talking to people who conduct personal security courses. One of the things they say you should never, ever do in these situations is to say to yourself, "This isn't happening."
Mm.
Did you do that?
I did. What I was thinking is, it's not going to be this bad, you know, if I do nothing to make him angry. I even thought he would take me home again. I mean, you know, you do start thinking irrationally. I didn't want to think of the worst in the situation, so I made myself think of the best, that, you know, he just wants to, because he was speaking to me and said to me, "I just want to use your car, I'm not going to hurt you." So, and you think of things of, I mean, I've also done self-defense courses now, and what I could have done and should have done. And at the time, I was just thinking, well, it's not going to be that bad. I don't want to do anything to make him angry. 80% of people apparently make the mistake when they're in the presence of a criminal is that we expect them to behave like most people in society. You know, if we don't anger someone, then there's no reason for them to come up and hurt us. And that's, you know, the mistake that I made in dealing with criminals who obviously don't work by that normal moral code.
What was his manner like? Was he shouting at you, or was he low-key and quiet?
No, he was calm. In fact, at one point I even thought it was quite strange, because I was quite comforted by it, that the way we were talking was almost as if we knew each other. And I was trying to keep it as casual as that because it made me feel better. Just talking, he was asking me, "Do I have a boyfriend? What's my name?" I used a false name. I said my name was Susan. But it was very there was a lot of silences, but when we spoke it was quite casual.
It sounds like you were both trying to keep each other calm.
Well, I certainly was trying to stay calm. And, you know, he obviously had planned it, but his adrenaline must have been pumping, because now he's obviously got his victim here now. Yeah.
So what? Where did he take you? He was driving the car.
Well, yeah, he had to go and find the other guy because they had been looking for a girl together, but the other one hadn't thought they'd find anybody. So he drove to, a predetermined place where he picked up the other guy and started taking me to an area, a bushy kind of desolate area on the outskirts of the city.
Right out of town.
Yeah.
And did he take you then off the road?
It's kind of an area where there aren't any street lights. It's around the coast, and the beaches on that side are more rocky, and a lot of criminals and vagrants, unfortunately, live in the bush there, so it's known as a dangerous area. And there are some clearings in the bush there where obviously you take a road off into the bush and stop in a clearing. That's where they took me.
And once they pulled over, that's when I suppose you couldn't escape the conclusion that this was happening, this was real, and it wasn't going to be good.
Well, strangely enough, I still didn't want to admit it to myself. And so when they stopped the car, I kind of just said, well, now what? I think I really didn't want to wait in suspense. And as you say, I probably was coming to the understanding, but I didn't want to come to the decision for myself. And that's when they said to me, we want sex. And he said to me, are you going to fight? And that, I think, is, many women do ask me, what should you do? Should you fight? Should you not? I think that we should give ourselves the tools of learning some kind of self-defense to choose to fight if we think the moment is right, because I think each situation would be different. But I, of course, at that time hadn't ever thought I'd find myself in a situation like that, so I decided the best thing to do was not.
And why would you ever imagine yourself in that situation?
Exactly.
I mean, who can go through life preparing thoroughly for that moment,
no.
I wonder?
You know, even though I've been through it before, I still have to question, if it happened again, how would I react? Because I don't think we ever know. Even we can learn, we can learn how to defend ourselves. We can try and prepare our children if you find yourself in this situation, what you should do. But when you're actually in the moment, you will react.
So then they sexually assaulted you, both these men. What happened to your mind while this was taking place, Alison?
That was something that I don't remember a lot of what I was thinking, because I was consciously trying to fill my mind with thoughts that weren't what was happening to me physically. And I remember I put my hands on the ceiling of the car, so I didn't have to touch them at all. And I just tried to think of other stuff. I didn't want to think about actually what was happening. And like I say, I don't remember most things, but one thing I do remember, I think because it kept on repeating itself, and that was, don't worry, this is not you that they're doing this to. This is just your body. And it kept on repeating itself, and I really did feel some power from that. I didn't know much about the crime of rape before this, and what I do know now is, above all else, it's a crime of power. And yes, they did have power over me physically, obviously, at that moment. But it was amazing to know that never did they have power over what I like to call the real Alison, the me inside. And I think it's something that we can all use, really, in our lives. We're all in moments sometimes where we don't feel in control of the physical environment. But I think it was good for me to remember that no environment, no person ever controls me and what I choose to do in a situation. It did help me.
Was it a voice, an inner voice, or was it just a flash of understanding?
I don't know. People have asked me, did I pray? Did God speak to me? I think it's all one and the same, to be honest. And I think it's a God-given intuition. It's a God-given, I don't remember it being a voice, or it being me, or it being someone else. I just remember it being an understanding, as you say. Yeah.
So it was a part of your mind that was, I don't know what the right word is then, I'm just reaching for words here, floating above the ordeal that was happening underneath it. Is that a good way of putting it?
Yes, because I think, we live most of the time in this physical dimension. And most of the time, that's quite okay, and we don't have to be trying to remove ourselves from it. But I think in a moment like that, where physically it's just too much for the mind to handle, it was a safe place for me to be able to remove myself to and try and forget and switch off from what was happening to me physically. And really what came to me in that time was, it's okay. The physical actually is not as important as we think it is, Let them do what they do to your body. That's not you.
My guest this morning is Alison, who survived a terrible attack in South Africa some years ago and now talks to victims groups and business leaders about her survival and the lessons she thinks that other people can take from her own experience. So once these wretched men had finished, what was your state of mind like then, Alison?
I was scared. I remember being, if I have to try and remember it, which I can do at any time, it was being scared of not knowing what was going to happen, but knowing it's not going to be good kind of thing. I didn't know that they were necessarily going to kill me, because they didn't ever threaten to, but they started speaking about leaving me in the bush with no clothes on to walk back into town. They were speaking of taking me back into town and would I go to the police, and I tried to convince them that I wouldn't. I didn't know at the time, but they had actually raped a girl just 2 weeks before me. She was a pregnant girl, and she had gone to the police, and they had actually been let out on bail. I'm not sure what it's called here in Australia, the same thing, yeah. They'd been let out on a very small amount of bail, and sort of naughty boys come back, you know, to court in a few weeks' time. And I mean, it shouldn't have happened to me. They should have been. So they didn't believe I wouldn't go to the police. And then they spoke about that. While they were speaking, one of them said to the other, "What do you think Uncle Nick wants us to do with her?" And Uncle Nick, Nicholas, are other names that apparently Satanists use for Satan. They have nicknames like that. And later on in the court case, they did, yeah. They tried to say they were Satanists, and possibly they were involved in it. I mean, I don't know. But I don't believe that night that they were out of control, which is what they tried to convince the judge, and he didn't, you know, believe it either. But that is possibly where the intent came from, I'm not sure. But they planned what they did. They knew what they were doing. And the answer to that question was, I think he wants us to kill her.
Were they using names for each other?
Yeah.
How were they using those names, and were they their real names?
No. The elder one, his name was Franz, but when he first introduced himself to me, he called himself Clinton. I don't know why. The younger one never really introduced himself, but in their conversation during the time when I was with them, they both used their real names for each other, and that's what I remember being quite proud of the fact that I had that information and that I would hold on to that and give it to the police.
So you were listening for this stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Alison.
I was listening. I was watching them. I still think I would have been able to identify them by their hands if I'd had to the next day. I was watching their hands, their feet, their clothes, what they look like, any tattoos, scars. I was watching that. It was, in a way, keeping me calm. It kept my mind busy. All the time I was watching.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You really find out what the human mind is capable of under these circumstances. Part of you is detaching yourself from the awful physical reality of it. But another part of your mind's really in the moment to pick up details. How old were these men, anyway, at the time?
I was 27. The elder one, Franz de Toy, is 26. He was actually married with a two-year-old child. Horrendous, I mean, for her and for the child. And the younger one, Tien Kruger, was 19.
19.
Yeah.
And although they'd had these pseudonyms, they in the moment, they dropped them.
Yeah.
And that's when you had their names.
I had their names.
So you're hearing, are you getting dressed while you're hearing them say these things?
I did dress again. And then after they'd spoken about Uncle Nick and after they'd spoken about leaving me there in the bush and discussed what they were going to do, Franz, the elder one who was sitting in the driver's seat next to me, said to me, "Get undressed again." So I really thought what was going to happen is they would leave me out there naked to walk back into town. I mean, to the point that I actually thought to keep my sandals on. I think it was once again the thinking calmly, the trying to be practical. I even thought to myself, you've got a good 10 kilometers to walk through this bush to get to the first streetlight. You know, keep your sandals on because you're going to need them.
Breaking it down step by step, this is what's required practically of me to get myself out of this situation.
Yeah.
But then they didn't.
No. They had, as I said before, they had planned what they were going to do. It came without any warning. They didn't have to discuss it further. From his position next to me in the driver's seat, I was still in the passenger seat. He just rolled over me. He kind of sat over me, straddled me with his legs. His hands went to my throat, and all in a split second, he started to strangle me. And I mean, what do you say? But I just remember looking up at him, and when I realized what was happening, I just said to him, "Please don't kill me." And just as I passed out, it all happened very quickly, I just heard him say, "Sorry." I don't know what that meant, but that's all I heard him say, and then I was unconscious.
At what point did you come round?
What happened, and I only know this from the court case and them admitting to what they'd done, most of the injuries actually happened while I was unconscious, which is a blessing, really. I think it is part of what saved my life, because I didn't obviously use up any energy in defending myself. But they pulled me from the car, front stabbed me in the lower abdominal region. He said later he was trying to ruin all my female organs. I'm not quite sure why he was doing that, but it's fortunate in a way, because there's so many other things, the heart, the lungs, that he could have stabbed. But he stabbed in excess of 35 times in my abdomen while I was unconscious. And then Tiens, the younger one, cut my throat for the first time. And Franz said, in his own words, he said he just went berserk, pushed his friend out of the way, and he continued his frenzy at my neck. But for some strange reason...
What, you mean like cutting or stabbing?
No, just cutting, slashing. I mean, my mother, slashing is a horrible word, but it is. He counted 16 times. And I woke up while that was happening.
You woke up while that was happening? Mm. Did you feel searing pain
of that? No. There are many what I account to be miracles that happened that night that are the reason that I'm alive. And one of them is that I felt no pain. In fact, the first time I felt any physical pain was when I woke up in hospital after the surgery and everything the following day. So I woke up, I'd been unconscious, I couldn't really see clearly yet. I could never, in fact, testify which one of them it was. But I woke up without any pain. I had no idea that I'd already been injured in my abdomen. And I woke up and saw this shadowy figure. I'll never forget, it was quite surreal because I saw this shadowy figure with the full moon behind him. It was quite this horrifying picture, really. Full moon behind him, this shadowy figure. And from his action, what I could see of his arm, he was cutting my throat. But I couldn't feel any pain. So it was like being in a nightmare. And it all happened, obviously, in a split second that I became more conscious, tried to wake up out of it, whatever, that I remembered then. That I'd been with them in the car, that they'd strangled me, and in that horrifying second, realizing this is not a dream. This is really happening.
Were you panicked in that moment, despite the lack of pain?
No. Immediately what hit in was an instinct, just to pretend to be dead. I cannot tell you where it came from. I just stopped breathing, because I was breathing actually through the injury. What had actually happened in cutting my throat, he'd opened up my airway. And in fact, what the doctors have told me is that if he had not cut my throat, I would have died of loss of oxygen, because with the strangulation, he'd actually pinched my windpipe closed. Incredible. The cartilage rings or something that are in our throat had actually been pinched on my windpipe, and I would have died not being able to breathe. With the fact that he cut my throat in so many times, when I woke up was when he actually cut through the windpipe, opening it up. So...
Alison, were they enacting some kind of, I mean, full moon, were they enacting some kind of ridiculous ritual they'd picked up off the internet or something?
I don't think so. You know, I was with them for several hours. I don't believe that they were in any way following out anything. I mean, I don't know much about Satanism, but there weren't any, incantations or candles. There was nothing, So to me, they blamed it on that later because it would have been easier. And like I say, maybe they have... watched movies or walked around graveyards or whatever and had the intention of being evil from that, but certainly that night they had planned it and they were doing it just with their own minds.
No, I'm sure it was much more, squalid than that. I mean, maybe just a couple of psychopathic horror movie fans who were looking for some kind of framework for what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, there was no from their upbringing explanation, really. The elder one had his father as a policeman. When I saw their parents at the court case, they were normal people, horrified by what their son had done. The younger one was more of a, hadn't really known his parents and had been more unloved in his childhood. But still, I think they just were lost on there.
They'd cut your throat 16 times, but somehow they hadn't cut your jugular vein.
I know. And the doctors say it was so close because they had cut the muscle, which is just on the outside of the jugular vein, and the jugular vein has a skin or a sheath or whatever you would call it around it where the knife had actually been. They could see the knife, where the knife nicks had been. So it was incredibly close that they...
And in that tiny, tiny half a millimetre is life and death for you.
Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly. Well, many things. I mean, the thyroid gland, which sits in front of our throats, is apparently very vascular and apparently bleeds a lot. And if in surgery, the surgeon might nick it by accident, they really have a problem trying to get the blood to stop. Mine was cut in half. So, I mean, from that injury, I should have bled to death as well. It's incredible the injuries that I had. In fact, the doctors called it a miracle, and I remember the particular doctor who worked with me, he said he wanted to be able to scientifically explain it because he's a doctor. And he said he just couldn't, from the injuries that I had, that I survived them.
A freakishly awful ordeal with a freakishly weird outcome here. So your throat's been cut, you're playing dead. Can you hear? What did they just leave you for dead there?
Yeah, they moved over to my car. I heard them throwing all my belongings, my clothes, talking about me. I remember one of them said, is she dead? And the other one said, no one can live through that. The only regret I have is that I didn't actually see their faces when they heard that I was alive, because they must have been amazed. And then they got in my car and drove off and left me there.
You were well off. How far from the road at that point, Alison?
a good 80 meters, you know, through the sort of winding little dirt road going to the tar road.
What? And you knew you could, you still thought you could survive.
Well, that was the moment that I actually had. It's in a moment that I don't often speak about, because it's like I was even saying earlier on, the physical plane that we live in, there are no words to explain it. But there was a moment when I believe I'd actually left my body, which I would say I did die. And there was a moment when I looked down on my body, and I remember the only thing I can explain to you in words that we have to explain it is this feeling of complete calmness, and knowing that if I were to, you know, go back and try and survive, it was okay. If I chose to stay and, I suppose, die, it would also was also okay. There was no judgment. I remember being distanced enough from my body to feel sorry for the girl who lay there. I remember that feeling very clearly. But at the same time, I knew it was me. And I remember there was a branch between myself and where the body lay. In fact, I went back after coming out of hospital to go and see, because it was so dark and I obviously hadn't really seen properly that night. But I went back to see exactly, and there was definitely a branch where this all happened.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
My guest today is visiting from her native South Africa. Alison is her name. She still prefers only to use her first name. She's in Australia to give some talks about a truly dreadful ordeal she survived some years ago, where she was sexually assaulted and mutilated by two men who, well, we'll find out what happened to them now after that attack and how you survived it. Just before the headlines there, Alison, you were telling me how you had that very odd experience. Some people... other people who've come on this program have talked about experiencing this in different circumstances. Yes, even Adam Gilchrist, actually, funnily enough, that sense of being outside of one's own body and looking upon it and feeling sorry for yourself. Did the thought occur to you as you looked, you had that sense of looking upon yourself, that oh, I must help that person?
Yes, like I say, I felt sorry for the girl. I felt I had the choice, but at the same time, like I say, I knew I was not going to be judged whichever I chose. I didn't see lights and hear voices, and I don't think I was, you know, the experience wasn't that involved. But I remember knowing that I could go back and help her, or I could stay where I was, and it would be okay, whichever I chose.
Did you think you had the choice to die then?
Yes.
Why didn't you choose to die?
I knew I was worth fighting for. I knew I didn't, you know, my life was worth more than that. It was worth more than dying like that then.
Did you ever sense there might be some comfort in death?
Very much so. I first, once I decided to try and survive and was back in my body, I crawled for a little bit of a distance for about 5 meters. When I pushed myself up to crawl, I realized I was also injured in my abdomen. And I had to hold, I mean, it sounds terrible, I know, but I had to hold, with so many injuries, I actually had to hold my intestines in with a shirt that they'd thrown out because I was so badly injured. And I crawled probably 5 meters and I couldn't anymore. I just collapsed, and I remember I wanted to die then. It would have been a release. It would have been the noise of breathing through the injury in my throat, the being alone there in the dark, not knowing if I was going to make it to the road, if anyone would even come on that desolate road to find me. It just felt futile. I didn't think. I knew by that time I realized how badly I was injured, and most of me knew I wasn't going to make it, so I would have preferred to die at that time.
And yet there's pragmatic Alison, who's performing triage on herself in a funny sort of way, holding yourself together literally in the most in the most profoundly literal sort of way.
And I think it was, you know, from the previous, in the attack when I was with them, that ability to stay calm. In fact, the police actually spoke to me afterwards, and they really think that that was part of what saved my life. And the part that I was actually not in a panic, I was able to stay calm, able to watch them for ways to identify them, able to think my way through, that almost continued in this completely horrifying fight to survive, that I knew I had to hold. I mean, I eventually had to hold my head too because of the muscle being cut on the side. So once I actually stood up to, I just thought, just keep going.
You stood up?
I had to. Crawling was just too awkward. I know it sounds not very practical, Wish you could see your face.
Alison, I'm not going to criticise any of the decisions you made at that moment.
No, the crawling was too awkward. You know, crawling, because I was holding my intestines with one hand and crawling with one. I mean, crawling with one hand is not easy at the best of times. And obviously for me, don't imagine the situation, but you can imagine it was awkward. So I managed to stand up because I thought if I'm going to make it at all, I have to stand.
But you couldn't keep your head upright.
No. I had to hold my head, literally I had to hold my head on with my one hand. And
so then you got to the side of the road.
Yeah, after I don't know how long, I got to the road and I lay across the white line in the middle of the road because I thought, well, if anyone comes, they're not going to miss me. That was to me, I mean, I didn't know how long I still had to live. I didn't know if anyone would come, but I figured if I lay in the middle, no, anyone who comes wouldn't miss me.
And what happened when someone did come?
Well, the first car came. No one ever got out of the first car. And it was a panic for me, knowing that someone else might not come. But to be honest, I've never felt angry with those people because I was lying in such a dangerous area. And it is notorious for, you know, false hijacks. And maybe someone would have thought that whoever had attacked me was waiting in the bush to attempt to attack the next one. I'm not sure. Maybe it was a girl on her own. But I didn't know if anyone else would come. I still don't know who that person was in the first car.
What did you see when that car approached?
I didn't see much because my head with the muscle was turned away from the car. I just knew it was there because the engine was idling. I could hear it. The lights were on me. But after a while, the car went by and went on. But then soon after that, a car did stop with open doors. People got out. It was chaos. People were screaming. But these were the people who actually landed up helping me and keeping me alive.
What, they bundled you into the car?
No, they didn't, actually. The one guy had some medical knowledge. His name was Tion. I've stayed in very close contact with him because he truly was one of the heroes that saved my life. He was only 20 at the time. But he knew how to stabilize, keep my blood loss down. He sent his friends to phone on their cell phones for the ambulance. And they were obviously assuming that the ambulance would be there soon. They'd be able to stabilize me. I couldn't speak because of the injury to my throat, so he was using communication of squeezing my hand. He said to me, I'll ask you questions. Squeeze my hand once for yes and twice for no. And that's how we communicated.
You're still conscious.
Fully.
And what was he asking you?
He asked me about what had happened, and I was able to tell him it was two white guys in a yellow Renault. I wrote letters on my chest, and they guessed, which I thought was quite clever of him to think to ask, because the police could be given a vague description of who, because, I mean, the guys were out there somewhere in my car. So they knew who to look for. But then I think to keep me awake, he was asking me stuff like, do you have a boyfriend? And do you want a boyfriend? And we must go out for dinner sometime. And, you know, you've got beautiful eyes. Look at me. And it was lovely. He was
what a wonderful man.
No, he was lovely. He was lovely. And a 20 to think to do those things. And it took, for some reason, we've never really actually been told exactly why. No one ever took responsibility for it. It took just short of 2 hours before an ambulance actually got to us. And he obviously, you know, some people say to him, why didn't you just get her in the car and take her? But you know what it's like when you're expecting the ambulance to be there within 5 minutes. And they had me stable. I wasn't bleeding anymore. So.
And there's dangers in moving you too.
Exactly.
So you had actually managed to write something in the sand, though, before you were found.
Yes, before I actually crawled out of the bush, I wrote their names. And I told you earlier, I mean, I'd held on to knowing their real names. I wrote their names in the sand, and I also wrote, I love Mom. I wanted my mom to know. That was when I thought I was going to die, to be honest, you know. I thought that would be my last message. I wanted her to know that I'd thought of her then at the end.
So I suppose you must have blacked out at some point, and you have no memory of what would have happened for some time after that, Alison?
When was that?
After you were taken to hospital. Were you conscious?
No, I was conscious throughout the whole thing. When I got to the hospital, they made Tion leave me. The nurses at that point were really just getting me ready for surgery, and they didn't talk to me like he had been. I don't think they realized either that I was still fully conscious. And I just kept myself breathing. I waited until I got up into the surgery. They actually asked me to sign a consent form. And the doctor, I know, the doctor actually also, he said, he looked through this window into the operating room, and he said, this is his words, he said he saw this woman with her head being held on by her spinal cord signing a consent form. He said he couldn't believe that I could do what I was doing, or that I'd been asked to do what I was doing.
You've got to find that form and frame it, Alison.
No, I've got it. I have got it. But that was where the first time anyone, because Tion, one thing he hadn't asked me is how to get hold of my mother or how to get hold of anybody. So when I signed the form, I wrote my name quite legibly, actually. It was quite incredible. But I wrote Mom and her telephone number, and that was how they were able to then get hold of my mom.
So did you know you were safe then? Did you have this feeling of safety?
I had a feeling of safety. I remember the doctor came up to me. He was actually a throat specialist and was able to – I was going to need a throat specialist. And he was one of only two doctors in the city. Just happened to be – because he's a foreigner, he's a Bulgarian doctor, happened to be on call at the hospital I'd been taken to. And I remember his first words as he came up when he looked at the injuries, "I can do it." And I remember thinking, well,
do it,
you know, do it. And he did, yeah.
How long before you saw your mum?
She was there when I came out of surgery.
Those people who didn't help you, who drove up to you in the middle of the road and then drove around, there may well have been good reasons. They may have well have been frightened and have seen you as some kind of dreadful bait for another attack. But they must know who they are. They must still know you. The case became famous.
I've often thought about them.
They must have seen the case come to light, and they were, "Oh, that was us."
Yeah, I've often thought, and even when I've done my presentations and speaking in South Africa, I've often almost jokingly said to the audience, "Listen, I'm not angry with you. So if you're here, please come and tell me your story," because I've always just supposed why they didn't stop, and it would be interesting to know. There are many reasons that they couldn't have, but it doesn't really matter because, as I say, someone else did come, and maybe that was the reason that they didn't stop. That Tion, in his, you know, hero and angel disguise, was coming in the next car.
You don't sound like you have any. I mean, you don't sound like you have any bitterness towards those people who failed to stop for you. You have
no. You know.
Do you think they should come forward to be forgiven? Do you think that?
No, I think I hope they don't have issues with it themselves.
I'm sure they do.
You know, I have to ask myself what I would have done. To be honest, on that road, I'd been told all my life how dangerous it is and how dangerous it is on that road. As I say, you know, there's not much traffic. There are a few houses along, and maybe it was a girl on her own. Maybe it was someone who shouldn't have been driving along that road, out doesn't want to admit. I don't know.
How quickly were the perpetrators caught?
The following day. Because I lived. You know, they didn't really cover up their tracks because they thought I was dead. And they thought the police would only get all the evidence. They really didn't cover up any fingerprints or anything. And they, in fact, left my car abandoned somewhere in the city.
Are they a bit thick?
The younger one. Mm. Yeah. The older one's more intelligent, planned it. But they had actually realized they were going to get caught, but they were going to find another victim the next day and also rape her, and I think they would just have started a rampage. I think that what they started with me was going to result in many deaths if I hadn't survived.
They'd gotten a taste for it.
Yeah. With the fact that they'd been arrested 2 weeks before with the other rape case, they had identical photographs in the police files, and they brought them to me in the hospital the following day when I woke up, and I was able to identify them, so they went to arrest them.
You seem like you, meanwhile, were being patched up very, very, very well. Like there's, like I can see a scar on your neck. But
it took
a
while.
Like $1 million, Alison.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I mean, I've got scarring internally, externally, my stomach too. But, I mean, the healing has been incredible because with injuries like that, I could so easily have had some kind of pain for the rest of my life, or the fact that everything functions exactly as it did before. I did go back a year later for surgery where they rebuilt a stomach wall because there was no muscle left to repair. But it's incredible what they can do and how the human body does repair. I mean, they took muscle from my leg, in fact, and rebuilt an abdominal wall.
So you've been repaired while these guys are starting to go into the judicial process.
Yeah.
Did you dread the trial?
Yes and no. I saw it as a way of speaking publicly about what had happened to me. I felt proud of the memories that I had. I felt proud that I remembered as much as I did and felt sure of my memory that I was going to be able to be questioned on it. But I dreaded seeing them. Although I knew it was going to be safe, physically and practically, you know, the memory of it emotionally was hard to see them.
Where were you sitting in court when you did see them for the first time?
I wasn't allowed to go into court until I was actually giving my testimony. So I walked in. That's one thing I didn't realize. I walked in the door, and the way that this court was set up, they were the first row that I walked in on. You know, so they
were right there.
I saw their profile sitting. I mean, apparently there were three policemen between me and them, but the policemen I didn't even see.
Invisible.
I just saw them, and I actually was quite surprised because I was handling things pretty well. I had, you know, I'd become known as the survivor. I was strong. I was ready for the trial. I was physically, I had obviously healed quite a lot. So I was quite surprised myself at how much it hit me when I saw them.
How did they look to you once you saw them? Did they look still fearsome, or did they look strangely shriveled in the courtroom environment?
No, I was scared of them. I was very scared of them. And I had been advised, though, by, just in preparation for the trial, to, when I gave my testimony, to look at the judge and to look at the, the lawyers, not to look at them. And I'm glad of that advice, because I think even though they could do nothing to me, emotionally, I think it would have made me more unsettled if I didn't look at them at all while I was.
Did they look at all repentant? Did they look? No.
Not at all. In fact, they were cocky. They were kind of, cocky and full of themselves. And although they admitted to everything. They kind of had this feeling of, we'll be okay. It was quite surprising.
They pleaded guilty.
Yes.
And they looked cocky.
Yeah.
You must have just wanted to.
Well, not me so much. In fact, I think it was quite scary for them, because the gallery, the courtroom, where we could go and actually watch, was filled with my friends and ex-boyfriends and all my male friends. And
did that make a difference?
To have my friends and family around me, it was great. It was great. And even a lot of strangers. I mean, it was obviously, as I say, it was quite high in the media, so people did come and watch. It was difficult for me to have the media attention. Because I had to almost be careful of what emotion I showed, because it would be in the paper that night. And I didn't really feel like, sometimes it was quite funny. I would just make a comment to my mother, where should we go for lunch today? And in the paper it was, Alison looked at her mother with a pained expression or something. So we would
there was Alison.
Meanwhile, we were just thinking, have you got a pain tablet for me? Or have you got a... So... We got through it. We were just human. So, and I wanted to go every day. I wanted to be part of the process and not read about it only in the paper.
You can't be a martyr to the injustices of this world because you're a human being, aren't you, Alison?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not like that, is it?
No.
So with this court process taking place, do you think it helps victims to go to court, even if they don't get the guilty verdict?
I know it's very easy for me to say, because I did get a good sentence. I mean, the guys were sentenced to multiple life sentences. And for me, that is a fairly good sentence. I personally, the advice that I give to victims who sometimes come and ask me is that you will never get that moment again. And I feel that if I hadn't ever had the chance, there would have been always this thing that I didn't have my chance to actually speak publicly about what happened to me and actually within the judicial system. And I do think that whatever the result is, it's something that will benefit your own healing and your own journey of healing to know that you had that moment to do that.
Even if there's a hostile cross-examination?
If you are ready for it and you are prepared for it and and to be honest, because, there were times when, obviously, even in my case, when everything was so... obvious because of my physical injuries, and I know in some cases obviously there might not be, and so the woman who has perhaps been raped has to convince people of the case. Even in my case they tried, but I think once, if you know your memory of it and you're prepared to say, I don't fully remember that, but this I do remember, or have your moment, I think if you can make yourself do it and you're given the opportunity, it's a good thing.
And after the guilty verdict and the life sentences they've received, the folklore on this is that you'd get this great catharsis and there'd be what Americans call closure on the whole thing.
Closure, and as one of my friends said, well, now you can go on living your life as if it didn't happen, And obviously I know he wanted that for me, but that's not at all what happens.
In fact,
that was when it hit me. It was only after all the attention, when everyone else went on with their lives, and suddenly there wasn't the trial to focus on, there wasn't the policeman to go and see and discuss this whole thing with.
Maybe that was the end of the process that began with you crawling to the edge of the road?
That was the physical process, yes. I think the trial was, and in a way, when I look now, I think it did help me, because as far as the rape went and as far as the emotional trauma of being almost being killed and having someone try and kill you, I really only dealt with that 9-10 months later, because this happened in December 1994 and the trial ended in August the following year. And it was really only after that, when I was probably a bit more distanced from it and a bit maybe physically certainly stronger, is when I really started dealing with it on an emotional level.
So you would have been an absolute prime candidate for post-traumatic stress.
And I fell into it very...
What did it mean? Crippling anxiety or
it was,
what?
You know, it was the strangest thing because I'm not a naturally depressive person to... I just didn't care. I started not caring if I went to work. I didn't even care if I phoned them and told them if I was coming or not, which is unusual for me. I didn't care if I got up, if I ate... You know, what time I went to sleep. I didn't care if I answered the phone or not. It was a very numb feeling that I had for months.
How did you get out of that? Because you're clearly not like that now, Alison. So.
No, I mean there was therapy that I was continuing to go for, but really at that time it wasn't mattering, and I think probably I also stopped going for a time. And I wish I could tell you that something happened or I read a profound book, but for me what it was is I think it was that same love of myself that fought to live one day actually just spoke loud enough, and I remember questioning myself and saying to myself, why did you fight so hard to live? You know, if you in that moment when you were about to die, without really mentally choosing it, something inside you fought to live. Something inside you knew you were worth fighting for. And yet now you're allowing your life to be like this. You're not choosing life now. You're not choosing to be bigger than this thing now. And
so you found an answer to that question. Why did you fight so hard to live?
Because I knew I was worth fighting for.
Because I was worth it.
And it was something that is the upbringing that I had from my mother. My mother would tell me, I'm special. Not better than other people, just special. We all are. We have value. And that is that is what was built into me as a child, and I built on in later years. And I remember it. I mean, before my attack, that's what I would read about. That's what I would speak to friends about. That's what I would write letters from overseas about, would be about us as people and the value that we have and the uniqueness that we each have. And so it's something that was tested that night, and once again I had to realize through the depression. And I think it was just a slow process, but that was my realization. I actually do have a choice here. It's yes, I didn't choose what happened to me, but how I react to this is my choice. And if I choose rightly, I will choose for myself once again, and I will find whatever it is I have to find inside myself to get over this.
My guest in conversation is a woman who we use her first name, Alison. She's was at the centre of one of the most famous criminal cases in South Africa's history, where she'd been sexually assaulted, mutilated badly by two men. You've just heard her story of remarkable survival, and the case went to court. The perpetrators were found guilty and imprisoned. You're talking there about choices. Before we started this today, just before the conversation started, you and I were talking about, I was trying to remember the name of, I think it was a Holocaust survivor who had a similar idea. He said that even in something as truly awful as the Holocaust, there are still choices available to you.
I think it was Viktor Frankl who said something to the effect of, you know, someone else, a situation can take everything from you, but your right to choose how you respond within that situation. And that was in a nutshell what I think I learned through my attack and what I share with people when I do my presentations, because we are all faced in our lives with situations, problems, obstacles that we wouldn't choose for ourselves. I mean, none of our obstacles and difficult times would we choose. But what I think gives us the power in our lives and is to know that we choose how we respond. So we do actually determine our course in life. We might not determine how we're going to get there because of the issues. I mean, I wouldn't have chosen what happened to me. But I do think the way that I've handled it has determined the outcome up till now anyway. I'm happy now because I chose to be.
You're clearly remarkably brave, and everyone loves you being brave. But are you truly... Are you fearful? Are you a more fearful person or a less fearful person?
Okay. In as far as practical wise, I'm certainly more aware of it happening again. I mean, I was so unaware before, where now I would lock my car door. I'll be more aware as I move around in the world. You know, not because I think it's going to happen. I'm not so much fearful. I'm just aware. But having had this happen, I'm not fearful. I don't want anything bad to happen to me, but I'm not fearful of what might happen in my life. I know that I'll be able to handle whatever it is.
It doesn't get worse than that, Alison. It doesn't get worse, really.
I hope so. I hope I'm not going to have to... I mean, I don't know. You see, there's no guarantee, and I know that. There's no part in... There's no place in any of our lives where we get it signed off by God or any higher power that says, fine, you've had it all, you've had the worst. And I think that what we need to do is just remember that and prepare ourselves by... by valuing ourselves, like I was saying, because, I mean, if we are able to realize that we are unique, we have the strength inside us, then when we face these difficult times, which will come, we at least understand the choice that we have, understand the control that we have in those out-of-control situations.
Those men attacked you with a knife in your lower abdomen region, and they stabbed you, what, 35 times?
Yeah.
35 times.
About.
You've had two boys.
I have. Miracles. I wasn't sure if I was able to fall pregnant, carry them because of the, you know, the muscle injury. But, yeah, Daniel's already 5 and a half, so it was, well, 6 years ago I fell pregnant with him without any intervention, had a healthy pregnancy, both of them.
Wow.
Daniel and Matthew, yeah. I had cesarean births, which I was quite glad about, actually, that I was able to have a medical reason for them, because I admire any woman who's going to give natural childbirth. But the doctors were actually amazed when they operated on me and how well I've healed inside.
Do you experience any kind of lingering pain as a result of these attacks? Do you get muscular pain?
Not really. Little twinges, but it's really not anything to speak of. I mean, my neck is weak because of the neck injury, and in my stomach. It's not how you would feel, but it's something I'm so used to now. It's not really pain. It's just an...
And you speak it to business leaders and victims groups as well.
Yeah.
How does your story go over there? Quite frankly, I find myself fighting for self-control hearing that story. It's so truly horrific, Alison. What happens when you talk about your experience?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it is emotional, a roller coaster, because, you know, I tell it in a very matter-of-fact way. I realize that, and I have a certain amount of time to talk it, so I kind of like give it to people, and they have to sit there and hold on to their chairs. I realize that, but I believe, and what I've been told is that the thing that people leave with is that feeling of, well, if she can do it, then so can I. Whatever, you know, and that is why I do what I do. I think if I can make a difference by sharing my story, if some good can come out of it, then, and I do believe that all these years later, that by now the good has far outweighed the evil of that night. And that to me has been the ultimate overcoming, really.
One thing I find with guests, doing this program for several years now, guests who've endured terrible suffering is it tends to, I don't know, shear away a lot of artifice around your personality, and what you tend to encounter is a very authentic person. I think you're one of those people, Alison.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I do think so. I think we have, there's no reason to pretend or something when you've felt something of that degree, you realize that what is important. And I think what I realized, what was important in that moment of looking down on my body was the love, the personality, that everything else is actually, we know the things that we put so much importance on are not really important.
Alison, that's a lot to think about. Mm. It's been so great to meet you today.
Thank you
so much. And thank you for being so patient and telling your story
so
honestly. Thank you.
It was lovely
so
being here.
On ABC Local Radio, Conversations.